You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Welcome to another special edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute, featuring interviews that were recorded at the Quantum Foundations meeting in Arice, Italy in March, supported by COST. I'm Zia Morali. In our last podcast special, we heard from physicists Angelo Bassi and Giancarlo Girardi about quantum collapse models, which have been proposed to explain why the macroscopic world that we see around us looks so different from the fuzzy microscopic quantum realm. In this special edition, we'll be hearing from physicists who take a different view on quantum matters. Shelley Goldstein, a mathematical physicist at Rutgers University, spoke at the meeting about Bohmian mechanics, also known as de Broglie-Bohm theory, after the physicists Louis de Broglie and David Bohm. According to standard quantum mechanics, reality is inherently indeterministic. That is, you can't predict the outcome of experiments with certainty, but only the probability of getting a certain result. Particles can also be in two places at the same time and display wave-like behaviour. These properties are mathematically encapsulated by the so-called wave function, which evolves according to an equation developed by Schrödinger. Bohmian mechanics seeks to provide a non-spooky explanation for these effects in a deterministic framework in which particles have set positions but are guided around by the wave function, which gives rise to the strange effects that we observe. Later in this edition, I'll be speaking with Jean Bricmont, a theoretical physicist and philosopher of science at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium, about the sociological factors in the history of the development of Bohmian mechanics, which he believes have stopped the theory from becoming the mainstream view. But first we'll hear from Goldstein, who explained more to me about how Bohmian mechanics works and why he believes it provides the common sense fundamental framework for reality, during a coffee break at the meeting.
Okay, let me try to put this in the most provocative possible way. What Bohmian mechanics does to standard quantum mechanics is put the physics in it. What's missing in standard quantum mechanics is any clear commitment to objects, stuff existing on space changing with time. And I would say that's what physics should fundamentally be about. The arena in which things take place is space or space-time. There have to be things in the space or space-time. And standard quantum mechanics is terribly complacent about what's there, what exists, what the theory is fundamentally about.
So, you know, we talk a lot about quantum mechanics on the podcast and on our website, and we say things like, you know, cats can be alive or dead, particles can be in one place or another place at the same time. There's this thing called the wave function that somehow lets you calculate the probabilities of getting outcomes of certain experiments, but, you know, you can never know with certainty. I guess this is the kind of thing you're referring to, that we, you know, we don't really know what's going on out there. It's all very fuzzy.
But and the fuzziness is self-inflicted. It's that in the very formulation of the theory, there is a total lack of clarity as to what is actually fundamental in the theory. For example, let me ask you this question. What is the basic reality in quantum mechanics? What physical reality does quantum mechanics describe? If you look at what's said in the textbooks, it's said in textbooks that the state of a system in quantum mechanics, the quantum state, is basically the wave function. That seems like it's the only thing which there's any strong commitment to in the theory. It seems, if you look at the way standard quantum mechanics is formulated, it almost seems as it's the only object that they take seriously is the wave function. Anything else is almost disreputable. What Bohmian mechanics adds to the usual quantum mechanical description is the actual particles. In Bohmian mechanics, a quantum system or a quantum universe would involve a wave function of the system or the universe together with the positions of all the particles, which are taken seriously. Particles actually have positions whether we look or not. What Bohmian mechanics avoids is the vagueness of the usual theory and the implausibility of the usual theory arising from its invocation of additional axioms about measurement and observation. Usual quantum theory has, in addition to Schrodinger's equation as one of the basic axioms of theory, the evolution equation for the wave function, rules and axioms about what happens during measurement. I would say if you have a theory which has rules and axioms about what happens during measurement, that theory cannot be a fundamental theory, because measurement and observation are not fundamental. They are things which should be analyzed in terms of more fundamental things. Any device for making a measurement is built out of more fundamental, smaller objects, like, say, quarks or whatever. Observers are made out of fundamental elementary particles. If you want to understand what happens to observers in observation, you should be able to just analyze what the theory says about the behavior of the fundamental constituents of everything involved. So these axioms, which are about measurement and observation, should not be fundamental. They should be derivable from something which doesn't refer to measurement or observation.
So let's get this straight. We have particles and they're in certain positions, and we have the wave function that's playing some kind of role here. But how do we then, you know, explain, can we explain these experimental results where they say, oh, you know, particles don't seem to have positions before they're measured? You know, how does Bohmian mechanics go around, you know, explaining these results?
In fact, it explains every one of these paradoxical results you understand in a very clear way in Bohmian mechanics. So in Bohmian mechanics, as you said, you've got the wave function. It's given a clear role governing the motion of particles. It happens that when you analyze this motion of particles, all of the mysterious predictions of quantum theory simply emerge from analysis of this motion. In particular, the quantum uncertainty, the uncertainty principle, limits to how much you can know about a system. These are consequences of an analysis of what are the possibilities of gaining knowledge in a Bohmian universe. I don't know, what other mysterious thing you want to think about?
Well, let's talk about, say, the double slit experiment. That's something that people talk about. It's a prime example, I guess. Okay. It's a very standard one. And people will say things like, oh, you know, you'll send off photons towards, you know, a wall with two slits in it, and the interference pattern on the other side tells you that, you know, these photons had to travel through both slits at the same time. So what's happening in the Bohmian picture?
Well, the thing is that what happens, what definitely goes through both slits, let's talk about the two-slit experiment for electrons, because you have a clean Bohmian picture for electrons. The wave function definitely goes through both slits. The wave function, because it is a wave going through both slits, develops, like any wave would, an interference pattern. Now, the motion of the particle, the electron, is controlled by the wave. And when the electron goes far enough down away from the slit so that it's in the region where the wave itself is developing an interference profile, because it is a wave, this profile in the wave leads to a certain pattern in the possible trajectories. It's because the wave goes through both slits that the particle, vaguely speaking, knows whether both slits are open or not. It knows how to behave. It will behave differently whether both slits are open or only one slit is open, because its behavior is controlled by a wave which goes through either one slit or both slits, depending on whether there's only one slit open or both slits are open. So one has a completely clear, transparent, totally comprehensible understanding of the two-slit experiment in Bohmian mechanics. Not just the usual presentation, but even the most mysterious aspect of the two-slit experiment. Namely, if you do anything to gain information, to actually know, to see which slit the electron actually goes through, the interference pattern must be destroyed. And in Bohmian mechanics, you have a crystal clear picture of why this must inevitably happen, why the interference pattern must be destroyed by gaining knowledge.
So what is that explanation?
You have to take into account the fact that gaining knowledge means interacting with something, so that whether the particle went through the upper slit or the lower slit becomes correlated with some other apparatus degrees of freedom, which will contain the information about which slit the particle passed through. That's the whole point of doing a measurement, to establish such correlations which reveal microscopic information. But once you establish this kind of correlation, and of course this correlation has to be established in a Bohmian mechanical way if you're talking about a Bohmian understanding of what's going on, and in this understanding the Schrodinger evolution remains a fundamental equation. It plays a crucial role, just as it does in the usual two-slit experiment. And then if the relevant Schrodinger evolution now is going to be a Schrodinger evolution for not just a single particle, but for the particle together with the measuring device. And then when you analyze what the wave function is, must then be like, having obtained this information about what slit the electron went through, you find that the wave function, relevant wave function for the electron itself will decohere, we could say it that way. It will in fact decohere, because this gets a little bit technical, but when you take into account the fact that the wave function now is living in a higher dimensional space, which includes the degrees of freedom of the measuring device, you immediately see that the very fact that you obtained this information meant that the wave function guiding the electron is not going to be one which interferes with itself anymore.
Well, you're presenting a really convincing picture, and it's one which seems to get rid of some of the kind of the mysteries and the paradoxes that we're used to with quantum mechanics. But this is something that's been around for many decades, and yet Bohmian mechanics is not kind of, you know, the agreed upon interpretation of quantum mechanics, not that there is one. But, you know, given that, you know, you feel very strongly about it and it seems to solve a lot of problems, you know, why doesn't everybody just agree that, you know, this is the correct way of thinking about what's happening in quantum experiments?
Because physicists are people. And physicists, look, I'll tell you, let me give you my own reaction. When I first learned about Bohm's theory, I dismissed it. I dismissed it because my teachers told me it had to be wrong. Why waste your time looking into something which everybody assures you is wrong? So there's a huge amount of misinformation about it, and it seems perfectly rational to accept the misinformation because authority figures are conveying that misinformation. You should trust those people. Trusting those people, you will convey the same misinformation to your students. And so it's very understandable.
We're getting pulled away to go back into the lecture theatre. Let me just ask you quickly as we're walking. Maybe it's a little bit too cruel to ask you in such a quick, short amount of time. But people complain about relativity and, I guess, reconciling or getting some kind of relativistic version of Bohmian mechanics. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I would say that we've explored various possibilities for forming a relativistic version. It's not easy to do, but there's no reason in principle why it cannot be done, why you cannot make a Lorentz invariant version of the theory.
That was Shelley Goldstein explaining the physics underlying Bohmian mechanics before, as you heard from the bell, we were called back into the conference. To find out more about the history of the development of Bohmian mechanics and why it hasn't been seized upon by more physicists, I later chatted with physicist and philosopher Jean Bricmont, who jokingly refers to himself as a card-carrying Bohmian. He described the resistance faced by Bohm and de Broglie, along with other physicists who worked on the foundations of quantum mechanics, including physicist John Bell, who derived a theorem limiting the kinds of theories that can describe reality on the small scales.
So yes, Jean, I've been asking people this question. People who are, you know, fans of Bohmian mechanics, it's been around for many decades, and I spoke with Shelley Goldstein, who gave me a very nice account of all its advantages and how it sort of gets rid of some of the paradoxes and the weirdness of quantum mechanics. And so my question then was, you know, why doesn't everybody accept this, or everybody being all physicists? Why are there so many other interpretations hanging about?
Okay, there are many reasons for that. There are sociological and historical reasons for that. And then there are sort of somewhat scientific reasons. So let me start with the sociological, historical reason. I have a whole chapter in my book about that. You have to look at the history of quantum mechanics. You have to realize that Schrödinger and Einstein understood entanglement and non-locality before, and de Broglie also, before the others. But then, you see, they were basically laughed out of court. I mean, de Broglie was, you know, sort of put in an embarrassing situation in 1927. He didn't have a full-fledged theory, then he abandoned it. And then it was rediscovered in 1952 by Bohm. Einstein didn't like the non-locality, which is in also in Bohm and de Broglie, so that didn't change anything. And he was always trying to explain that if the world is local, then quantum mechanics must be incomplete, and people did not understand him. You can demonstrate that Bohr does not understand him, that Bohm did not understand him. You know, nobody except Schrödinger. Schrödinger has a paper, you know, on the present situation of quantum mechanics, which is very clear about, you know, the problem of entanglement and the non-locality. But the other people did not. Then there was the influence of positivism, or at least an understanding of it, that, you know, whenever there is a crisis in science, like there was in the beginning of the 20th century, people fall back on what dating is absolutely certain, namely logic and raw data, you know, sense data. And the positivists were pushing in that direction. I think you have different trends in science, for example, behaviorism in psychology, the Copenhagen interpretation, frequentism in the theory of probability, formalism in the philosophy of math. There have been various things. Let's say, let's not ask too many questions because we'll get wrong, okay? We have gotten wrong enough in the past with classical mechanics and so on. So let's be as, you know, as descriptive and phenomenologist, and or stick to pure symbols, etc. And I think this has been the general trend in the 20s, 30s. That's one of the explanations why people said, okay, let's... And also, there is another thing which has to be said in favor of that. There has been tremendous development in nuclear physics, in atomic physics, in solid-state physics, after the war, in QED, particle physics, etc. So people said, let's not worry about the questions. And there is some merit to that, because they did make progress. We can't deny that. Okay, then we come after the war. After the war, you know, it shifted from Middle Europa to, because of the war and Nazism and so on, to the US, the center. But in the US, the philosophy was so-called pragmatist, which isn't pragmatism in the sense of peers, but it's really shut up and calculate. Okay, that was the philosophy. I knew this philosophy because I came later, of course, but it was still dominant, okay? So don't ask questions. And that, again, as I say, it was fruitful in some sense, but it was one of the reasons people didn't like Bohm. Then, of course, Bohm was also caught in the Cold War. You should read, for example, Clauser, who tells about the history that you couldn't... There was a stigma attached to Bohm because he had been sued because of McCarthyism and so on. And then the whole psychological atmosphere was very hostile to Bohm because, you know, Oppenheimer didn't like him, and then he went to the Institute for Advanced... Somebody went to speak about his theory at the Institute for Advanced Study, and he was, you know, completely... laughed out of court. I mean, he was completely disregarded, and some physicists telling, you know, Oppenheimer say it's juvenile deviationism, we should ignore him if he can't refute him, and a very hostile reaction. That was partly because he was against the orthodoxy and partly because of the politics. Then he had to leave the U.S. for political reasons. He lost his job in Princeton, couldn't find employment in the U.S., had to go to Brazil. That was a sort of a backwater back then. And then he was sort of, you know, marginalized into Israel and England. He was marginalized all the time. And so, and then he was a little bit mystical, so that didn't help.
No, what I wanted to ask you was you're giving this account of how Bohm was treated, and sort of treated quite shabbily, you know, because of his ideas, and they were kind of thrown out. But that made me think of Hugh Everett III, who also, you know, he came up with this interpretation, the many worlds interpretation. We've talked about it a lot on this podcast and on the site. And he also, you know, he had a pretty bad time of it in terms of a reaction to that. So, you know, in that, but actually that's had a massive resurgence over recent years. So can you compare, I mean, I don't know if you can compare the two, or I'm just making a comment or not really asking a question, but I guess it's something, you know, along the lines of, you know, is this something just to be expected if you come up with a theory of quantum interpretations? And then why does one make a resurgence and the other not so much?
Well, I'm not so sure that the Bohmian doesn't make resurgence. I think there are more and more people interested in that. So that I'm not so sure, because it depends how you count also. But then, as I say, de Broglie also had problem. De Broglie, for reasons which are not clear to me, but what also probably partly political, was marginalized in France, and then he made bad appointments and people didn't like him and so on. But that's not clear what the reasons are. I mean, I didn't really learn the life of de Broglie. But, you know, I mean, the whole situation was, you know, pretty bad. If Bohm had stayed in the U.S., he might have had another impact. But the fact that he was marginal was a basic problem. And then Bell, you know, I mean, the stigma problem is that even Bell never spoke at CERN about his interest for quantum mechanics before he came to a conference, I think, somewhere there was a summer school in 76 or something, but he didn't talk about that before. He was hiding that from his colleagues. I mean, you couldn't even discuss these things when I was young. I've known that myself, you know, it's very hard to discuss. So, and I think the main stumbling block among physicists is to make them worry, you see, realize the me worry attitude. Why should I worry? I mean, well, you should worry for two reasons. First of all, it's way past the time where the attitude that we don't care was fruitful, because I think it's fair to say that physics has come not to a halt, but to a plateau. I mean, you know, it's not clear that string theory goes anywhere. You have the standard model, but that we have seen in the 70s. It's beautiful and everything, but then we can sit down maybe and think about what we have been doing since 1925 or 26. Okay, what was going on? And it would be useful to understand that, to explain to the student, to stop mystifying the public, the general public, to shut up all the bad philosophy that goes around that, etc., etc., not to speak of the pseudoscience. So I think it would be very useful at this time in history, I'm not saying necessarily in the 30s, but now, to sit down and think about what we are doing. And it seems to me that Bohm is the only reasonable answer, and I don't think most people adopt the many worlds. There are, in the people who worry about foundation, there are people who are many worlds. There are also cubists, which is sort of Copenhagen with a vengeance, but it's, sort of worse than... The thing is that you have to convince the ordinary physicists that there is a problem and that there is a solution. Because then they think, you know, Bohm has been discredited so much. There are so many millions of qualities in Bohm which are viewed as defects that before you start, you know, raising the real issues, you can't even get the issues on the table. So why be surprised that people don't like it? I mean, you know, it's like somebody who had an unfair trial. You have to wait for a fair trial, and that can take a long time.
Thank you to Jean Bricmont and Shelley Goldstein. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find more information about the COST meeting on quantum foundations in Arice, Italy, along with links to an article about Bohmian mechanics involving Shelley Goldstein. You can also read more about the alternative many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics there. There'll be more from the meeting in Arice on the next main edition of the FQXI podcast, when we should be back to the usual format. Thank you for listening. I've been Zia Morali.